Welcome to the Cloud Pod, where the forecast is always cloudy. We talk weekly about all things AWS, GCP, and Azure. We are your hosts,
Justin,
Jonathan,
Ryan,
and Matthew.
Episode 266, recorded for the week of June 25th, 2024. AWS billing finally comes into focus. Good evening, Matt, Jonathan, and Ryan. Full house.
Hey, Justin, Ryan.
Woo.
Woo.
Well, last week spent a fantastic few days at the FinOpsX conference, which if you have not been or have been thinking about going, I would definitely recommend going to the FinOpsX conference. It is fun to go to a conference where you don't have to explain to people what FinOps is. They just know, which is sort of, because anytime you mm-hmm. mention FinOps, they're like, what? What's that? And you would explain it to them. But it was good. It was great to get to see a bunch of people from the who listen to the show, as well as friends that I have in the FinOpsX conference, including Rob Martin and Joe Daly, etc. But overall, it was much bigger this year than it was last year, still at the beautiful San Diego Marriott Marquis, which is great because it's on the water. And so the weather was beautiful. It was 80 degrees while it was sweltering at my house in the East Bay of San Francisco. So it was nice. Overall, a couple of things I thought were interesting. Focus 1.0 is now officially generally available. And there was a lot of talk about adoption and all the cloud vendors taking advantage of the Focus standard. And then another big thing they talked a lot about is SaaS companies starting to take on the Focus standard as well. So Datadog, New Relic, Snowflake, these guys are all potentially going to be future adopters of Focus. And so really, Focus could become a global standard in how you do consumption-based billing reporting, which I think could be really interesting. So even as a SaaS company, where I work for my day job, we may have to eventually support Focus just so customers can get unified standardized billing for consumption services, which is sort of, didn't see that happening, but it's kind of interesting.
I mean, it's a natural progression given, how much of our workloads are being, sent to, SaaS providers like Snowflake or Confluent.
Mm-hmm.
You need to visualize and rationalize those costs the exact same way. Pretty cool, but it is interesting. Yeah.
We can see how it evolves. I think the Focus 1.1 draft is already going through. So this thing's going to continue to evolve a little bit, but it was fun. One of the sessions I did was a chalk talk, where basically you went and they gave you a piece of paper of a printed out charts drawn on the graph paper, and then all of the schema of the Focus 1.0. And basically your goal was on a whiteboard was to draw out how you would use the schema to basically recreate the charts that were on the piece of paper. And so I luckily had a data analytics person in my little group, and she knew what she was doing, and she just busted out some beautiful queries. But it was fun to just talk about it and like how you might use the things. And we had a whole debate about, there's two fields for build date. So there's the date you consumed it, and then there's the date you were billed for it. And so those can be two different dates based on the way cloud providers. And so both of those are reported in the Focus standard, for example, which is sort of interesting to think about, like, I can see why that's important for this or that, as well as just thinking about how you start figuring out differences between the different cloud providers, percentage of discounts, which are some of the charts that we had to do. So really interesting, really quite good. Like I said, the conference is bigger this year. It'll be there again next year. I think they will probably grow out of this facility at some point. I don't know when that'll be. I don't think they officially sold out, but they were selling tickets up until last week. And I'm sure some people don't show up and they kind of oversell the conference on purpose. But I think they had to probably expand inside of the conference center they're in just because it's a little tight. But there is one thing that happens at FinOpsX that I have seen at no other conference, which I think is pretty cool, is that on stage together, talking as one unit, is Amazon, Azure, and Google.
No Oracle is
here. Are they in like individual like glass pods or something?
No, they just put them in normal chairs. And then JR, who's basically the leader of the FinOps Foundation, did an interview session where they were talking about Focus and doing all the and adoption of Focus and what they're doing and cloud. And it's just fun to see them not be fighting with each other and just like on stage all talking about how they're making FinOps better and adoption of Focus and what they're doing. And then the second day they actually did a whole, each vendor basically had a chance to talk about all the FinOps announcements. They all announced something at Focus they all announced something around Focus as well as announced new features and capabilities at the conference, which was kind of nice to see because they didn't just save it for reInvent or Next. They actually had stuff there.
That's cool.
So not only is cost the common metric when you're trying to basically do any comparison across anything, but it's also, you know, bringing the world together.
Yeah, bringing the world
together. Three cloud providers at a time.
We all just want your money.
Yeah. Now my question is, you know, is Oracle going to get on stage with them next year? So that'd be kind of the perfect thing. You know, show floor, lots more vendors this year. Still a lot of old original Gen 1 FinOps tools. You know, Cloud Abilities out there, Cloud Health, you know, et cetera. IBM, you know, owns like 7 companies on the floor at this point. I don't know how many they own. It seems like they own everybody. And then there's a bunch of new vendors as well this year that, you know, had different ideas, different takes on things. You know, it's interesting because there was a really just clear distinction that JR made around AI for FinOps and FinOps for AI. Those are two different things. And so, you know, most of the vendors, you know, are doing some type of FinOps for AI. But, you know, I was talking to one vendor, Cloud Zero, and, you know, they were talking about, you know, you got to set up this very complicated YAML file to do your connectors and stuff like that. And I'm like, my first question is like, do you guys have AI for that? So mm-hmm. I don't have to do as much work on that. And they're like, oh, that's a really good idea. We should do that. I'm like, okay. So yeah. I see very quickly my mentality on vendors is going to start changing, where I'm thinking about like, how are you making AI make my life easier with your product? Which is sort of interesting, because I hadn't, you know, it was just one of these like moments in the show floor. I was like, okay. And then one of the companies I talked to last year, they were Stealth last year. They were actually out and announced. This year was Adaptive 6. I thought they were really interesting, because one of the things I talked to them about last year was, you know, FinOps tooling is great, but when you need to make changes to tags, you need to do different things, or you don't want them to use GP2 instances, you want them to use GP3, and the FinOps tool is doing it, there's no way to write that back to Terraform or write that back to the infrastructure as code you're ideally using to this. So they were showing in their solution, you know, they basically, it prevented someone from deploying 1,000 boxes with the GP2 versus GP3 for RDS. But then when it prompted them that they had done this thing, it said, well, would you like us to write you a pull request to fix it in the code? And actually wrote a pull request that in GitHub that would basically change it to GP3. Again, baby steps, very heavily AWS focused, but you know, the potential for Gen 2 FinOps tools, I think, is really interesting and really has a lot of high potential. And we'll see what they do next year.
What was the blocking mechanism? Is it permissions, or is it like you're executing the command through the
FinOps? They plugged into the Terraform flow of the Git. You know, basically it's part of the Jenkins or GitHub actions pipeline. And so basically detected that it violated a rule that you're using outdated infrastructure. And basically that's why I was able to prevent it. And then it gave you remediation, like, ignore me, go fix your code yourself. We can write a pull request for you. You know, we could open a Jira ticket, whatever mechanism you wanted to use to remediate.
Got it.
It's kind of cool that like FinOps is becoming like security, is where it's in the pipeline now and not just like something that someone just looks at afterwards and is like, cool. By the way, you just spent $100,000 in 3 days by accident because you did the wrong instance type. So, you know, it's kind of nice that you're getting these things in early and actually able to, you know, make it be what we want it to be versus then have to retrofit the world.
Yeah. The shift left of FinOps was a big topic. You know, how do we get visibility? How do we show people what things are going to cost? How do we make sure that, you know, people are aware of what they're doing? And so I think, you know, it's just a recognition of that is important, and just as important as security is your cost. And in some ways, security is part of your cost story, because if you bankrupt your company, that's a pretty bad security situation. Any other questions about FinOpsX? Again, recommend going in the future.
Did you go to the after party? They have it on the
Midway. Yeah, I did not go because I was invited to a dinner, but they did do the party on the Midway again. Goose and what's the other character from Top Gun? Tom Cruise's Maverick? Character. Maverick. Maverick and Goose were on the deck, so you could take photos of them on the Midway. But yeah, I didn't make it out there this year. I did last year. It's a great venue in general. It's a good party, good time, good food and music, etc. But I had other obligations.
That's cool. I'm really happy that FinOps has become this entity that's going to have sway over lots of different things in organizations now, because ultimately, I mean, somebody was always accountable for the cost of things, but not at this level. Mm-hmm. And I think having people who wear FinOps hats who get consulted around the use of services is going to be awesome. Just thinking about AI and how expensive that can be, I think FinOps will drive things like that you wouldn't have expected, things like data quality, because, you know, you start with better quality data, it'll lower the cost of building models, things like that. So I think we'll just see it driving improvements across the business.
Yeah. The sustainability as well. It's another big area of topic of how, you know, your cost of things and how it's driving your sustainability story, et cetera. That's a big deal too. Mm. Well, good. All right. Well, let's get into other news that happened during the conference. First up, DigitalOcean has announced that they're offering you managed OpenSearch. Launching a managed OpenSearch offering a comprehensive solution designed for in-depth log analysis, simplified troubleshooting, and optimizing application performance. With DigitalOcean, you can pinpoint and analyze log data with ease, customize log retention, enhance security, and scale with your business, and receive forwarded logs from multiple sources, including DigitalOcean managed services like Droplets and managed databases. And I really just put this story here because we don't really care about OpenSearch, but I really put it here because I wanted to comment more about the fact that OpenSearch has taken over the world. No one is doing Elasticsearch anymore. Everything is becoming OpenSearch very quickly. And I'm sort of intrigued to see if that follows suit with HashiCorp Terraform as well, with OpenTofu and OpenBao as IBM starts to consume HashiCorp, you know, probably by the end of the year. Kind of interesting. But yeah, great. If you're on DigitalOcean, another great managed service, including, you know, Kubernetes and other things they have now with OpenSearch.
Cool.
Yeah. No, anyone who can
let's pull bastards.
Orchestrate clusters of that is awesome in my book.
You did it. You just didn't. You lost hair because of it.
And didn't sleep for a few days. It's fine.
Not for a few days.
Weeks.
Years of our life.
Years. Yeah.
Yeah. There's the damage that occurred in the moment, and then there's the long term damage that we have yet to suffer from.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wonder if we're gonna make it like a retroactive claim for therapy.
Workers' comp, Jonathan. Submit a workers' comp claim.
I had to help Ryan. Well, I didn't really help. I just read his code. Not even his code, but someone's code that he inherited in PowerShell. And it had been a while since I looked at PowerShell, and I might need therapy for that too. Because it was spaghetti code of monster that I...
It's so bad. And it's so crucial. So it's always those, right? It's the important ones where everything revolves around it, and so no one touches it. And so they end up getting the worst spaghetti code, and it's old and tacked on. It always is.
Yeah. Well, then like trying to figure out the submodule mappings and how it pulls in submodules and the trying to chase back. Oh
yeah.
I'm like,
Me 3 months to understand that code, reverse engineering how it works. And now I've got it pretty down. So like when it breaks, I could fix it, but I wouldn't try to refactor it at all.
I think there was a moment where you were like, you posted a snippet of code and you're like, here's the problem. And I'm like, I don't freaking see it. And then I'm like, you're like Tank in the Matrix right now. You see the characters walking across the green screen, you know, the green text of the Matrix coming across. And all I see is green text. From the back.
Yeah.
And you were like, yeah, that's pretty accurate. And I was like, and I'm sorry. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so anyways, PowerShell code. Yeah. It's great. Mm-hmm. Don't use it. Python for the win.
Yeah.
Or Golang or something.
In Windows, PowerShell is actually getting pretty decent, I will say.
The reality is that all this code's fault is not really the fault of PowerShell. I'm actually always impressed by actually how well this code executes given how it's written. And a lot of that has to do with, you know, how PowerShell hands around objects and conserves resources that way, so it's actually kind of cool.
Yeah, if you didn't have to support it, it could be beautiful. Yeah. so well, if you want to talk about other beautiful code, let's talk about Rust. For Rust developers, you can now store and access your libraries known as crates on AWS Code Artifact. No additional Rust packages beyond the gigabyte stored requests and data transfer will be charged to you. And so you get the ability now to use Code Artifact like everyone else with your Rust packages and cargo paints.
That is, I mean, I'm a fan of never running a software repository again. And so it's the support of these new features and functions that allows that managed service sort of usage. So I think it's fantastic.
I'm mostly impressed it's got a full AWS blog post write-up. I'm like, you're just adding Rust support to Code Artifact. And like, no, they did, you know, 700 words on Rust and code examples and how to use it. And so if you're, Amazon might be getting big into Rust. I don't know, because like, this is a lot more than I expected.
I think so, because half the blog post is actually selling Rust as a programming language and saying how wonderful it is. So,
Yeah.
I've seen it happen. Like, I haven't tried to adopt Rust, but everyone that I know of. I've seen them happen like one by one, like becomes like that cultish Rust is amazing. So I think, you know, on at some point I'll have to join them. But
see, this happened to the Ruby community too. Everyone got really excited about Erlang. And I looked at that and I was like, this is a bad call. Like, abort, abort. And everyone else fell into Erlang and then realized that was terrible. And they ended up in Rust too, but they had to take that detour through Erlang. And I feel like Java is kind of, the Rust is kind of what the Java people all fall to. And then like someone's going to realize that Rust is terrible as well. Then something else will come out of it. And then they'll all end up over there. But I don't know if that is yet.
Yeah. Well, Java's terrible. So, I mean, I don't know if that's even, how terrible could Rust be to be worse than that?
I mean, that's possible, is that Java is just so bad that Rust can't possibly, like, I mean, because Erlang was bad and Ruby was not great either, as you guys like to point out to me all the time.
Here's Peter just to stick up for Ruby.
Yeah,
he's not here anymore. He left. Yeah. So, you know, like all Ruby people do, they just leave. They write a bunch of crappy code, they put in the code, and then they quit.
And you'll sucker. Never manage those dependencies ever.
Exactly.
Ruby gem hell. That's all I have to say.
I was reading about something with like some NVM environment manager for JavaScript, and I was just like, yeah, this reminds me just like RVM. Like, just as bad. This is horrible. Anyways.
Yeah. I think a lot of the problem with this, the perceived popularity of things like Rust, though, is a lot of it's come from people who've never used it. It's like they're buying into it on the sales points. Oh, look, it's memory safe. It must be amazing. I don't know how many people are using it, but to me,
could you imagine just like my entire reason for choosing a language is because it's thread safe or memory safe? Like, okay, that's good.
I mean, there's like valuable places you would want to guarantee things like that, but I think there are perfectly good tools for analyzing code anymore, which will solve that for you anyway. So, do I think we're going to port the whole Linux kernel to Rust? No. Are we going to start writing more device drivers and things in Rust? Sure. I think it'll be a hybrid effort, but no one's going to do a mass rewrite of anything.
So the Q1 2024 RedMonk programming language ranking has Rust in the 90th percentile of popularity on GitHub and the 75th percentile on Stack Overflow by number of tags that mention Rust. But then I get concerned because Kotlin and Scala are higher than it. And Ruby's over here to the right with TypeScript and Java, etc. So yeah, you know, how popular it is or not, it's hard to say. But I'm just going to see if Swift is past Objective-C. Objective-C is tough.
Yeah, I'm not sure Stack Overflow is a great metric. It just shows what people have problems with, not what people use.
Why it's two dimensions. It's popularity ranked by GitHub by number of projects that have the language, and then popularity ranked on Stackflow by number of tags. So
yeah.
I mean, you can challenge RedMonk methodology. I'm fine with it. Well, back to Amazon. Amazon is pleased to announce that Anthropic's Claude 3.5 Sonnet model is now available to you in Bedrock. They're the first one to announce it, but others will announce it today as well. Claude 3.5 raises the industry bar for intelligence, outperforming other generative AI models on a wide range of evaluations, including Anthropic's previously most intelligent model, Claude 3 Opus. Claude 3.5 Sonnet key improvements include visual processing and understanding, writing and content generation, custom support and natural language processing, analytics and insights, and coding and software development capabilities to help you write better code, or a sonnet of code.
I played with it today.
And?
And it wrote some code that ran first time.
Ooh.
What? First time.
Well.
Yep. I was like, written this, and I skimmed through it, like, yep, that looks good. Copy paste. Works first time. It's awesome. I also had it generate. So that was the LDAP group management stuff. I had it write. Mm-hmm. And then I also had it write a browser-based game, tic-tac-toe, in HTML and JavaScript. And it just spat that out like it's done it 1,000 times, which it probably has. but that worked fine. And I wanted to tweak it's like it's AI that it was playing tic-tac-toe with. So maybe a new version and I played it. It was like, no going back twice.
Did you win?
Did I win? Yeah.
Did you win the tic-tac-toe?
I did.
So it's not that smart.
Well, it always goes second, so.
Ah, well, that's bad. That's a bad move, tic-tac-toe.
I'll ask it to change that and see what happens. But no, I was super impressed.
You should play chess against it. See how your chess skills are against.
Yeah, I could try that. I did ask it about what his golf handicap would be, and then told me that that it would be better to have a golf handicap in the teens so that people didn't think it was too busy on the golf course instead of doing what it's supposed to be doing.
I mean, apparently while you're vice president of America, you can get your handicap down to 6. I think that's what he said. I'm not sure.
Yeah, who knows?
All right.
Don't we have a rule against talking about politics on this?
I didn't. I just talked about a debate that happened. That might be about politics.
Fair enough. Yeah.
Amazon is announcing the general availability of a fully managed MLflow capability on Amazon SageMaker. MLflow is a widely used open source tool playing a crucial role in helping machine learning teams manage the entire machine learning lifecycle, which is basically code to your ops team to do it for them. Customers can now effortlessly set up and manage MLflow tracking servers with just a few steps, streamlining the process and boosting productivity. MLflow can be used to track multiple attempts at training models as runs with experiments, which I don't need to track how many times I've tried and failed. Pair these runs with visualizations, evaluate models, and register the best models to a model registry. There are 3 core components to MLflow capability on SageMaker, including the MLflow tracking server, which is a standalone HTTP server serving multiple REST API endpoints for tracking runs and experiments, enabling you to better monitor your ML experiment. Next up is the MLflow backend metadata store, which is critical part of the MLflow tracking server, where all metadata related to experiments, runs, and artifacts is persisted. And finally, the MLflow artifact store, which provides a storage location for all artifacts generated during ML experiments, such as trained models, datasets, logs, and plots.
That's interesting because MLflow for years has been a competitor to SageMaker. In AWS, people have just deployed that and used it to manage running experiments and building models and the workflows around that. And so for them to bring it in like this is both interesting and kind of cool to have it as a managed service now. But No longer a competitor anymore.
Well, if you can't beat them, join them by making it part of your product.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Was it MLflow built by Databricks though? Or is it running in there? I thought it was built by, like open source by.
I don't know where MLflow exactly came from. It might have been Databricks and then they open sourced it. I don't know. But it's an open source project on its own now.
It was, yeah. It was open sourced by them. Huh? Okay. There you go.
I mean, what did Claude Sonnet say? I'm just glad to have more options because the more people want to do ML and AI stuff, the more you realize how much tooling you need to really make it successful. So having options is appreciated.
Yep.
So at FinOps X, Amazon announced the AWS Compute Optimizer is delivering you new recommendations for RDS MySQL and Postgres databases. These recommendations help you detect idle RDS instances and identify the optimal instance types and provisioned IOPS settings for your existing RDS DB instance, so you can reduce costs for over-provisioned RDS database instances or increase the performance of under-provisioned workloads. To right-size RDS databases, it takes in multiple variables and can be very time-consuming, and you need to dedicate engineering resources specializing in databases to analyze the cost and performance, and so the right-sizing recommendation makes that all easy and machine learning-driven. It makes your recommendation 2 parts. First, a focus on the DB instance size, and the second will be a recommendation for your DB instance storage.
I was really happy to see that they included the IOPS provisioning in this optimization. Just so many database engineers, they live by that one outage because of drive performance and all the SQL engines say you need to have this and all these things, and then it just sits idle, and it's so much cost. So this is pretty great to see because I think that, I think this is one area I know that most places I've worked where there's a heavy over-provisioning.
Well, A, because it takes those really, really expensive people who know what they're doing to do that, which is definitely a factor. It can be complicated very, very quickly.
Yeah. I think next step, though, check the button and make it adjust it for me dynamically. Need more apps? Give me more apps. Tell me what you're doing. Manage it for me. It's still kind of like, I know RDS isn't supposed to be a serverless service, but it could be a lot closer to being a serverless type service where you don't need to think about that stuff.
That'd be great. One thing it does annoy me slightly about RDS for this is that they still don't support savings plans for RDS. So if it does tell you that, hey, you should move to an M class from a C class instance type, but you had RIs on it, your host.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's why my one complaint. The storage works at any time because you can change that basically any time you want to. Even on RDS, RI, but I wish they would bring a savings plan or some form of savings plan that give me more flexibility here, then this tool will be perfect.
Yeah, but unlike Google, though, at least they have different classes of instances available when you need them.
Too soon, Jonathan. Too soon.
Don't worry. Azure's not far behind.
Not bitter at all.
Yeah. We need this instance type. We gave it to you. You didn't provision it fast enough.
Yeah, exactly. What? Infrastructure as code, as long as you give us 6 months notice that you want to deploy something. Okay. Yeah.
And then like when they give you, like you wait 3 weeks and they're like, here's the server, but you didn't provision it. So we gave it to somebody else.
Yeah.
Like, cause you just told me 10 minutes ago, my code doesn't run that fast.
I mean, I get that the quota is not necessarily representative of all the capacity they have available, but yeah.
Yeah. The quota thing is annoying too. Cause even, you know, even being able to automatically set the quota doesn't give you anything. So you can automatically adjust the quota up to higher levels and then they still don't have capacity for you. So then, you know, it's the one time where I finally realized that reservations might be important for DR. Because on Amazon, I would never have thought about it. Like, oh yeah, I need a reservation for these. Now I'm like, yeah, I might need reservations in the DR site because otherwise that capacity will not be there.
No.
Well, AWS billing and cost management has two new data export types. First of all, you can now export the cost optimization hub recommendations to S3. And if you're excited about that Focus 1.0, you in preview, you can export that to S3 as well. So all of your Amazon CUR data can now be in the new Focus standard. So you can use Focus for all your new reporting.
That's pretty great because that report is terrible to parse.
Yes.
Come on, it's fine.
No.
As I was telling Matt before the show, just put your billing data into BigQuery. It solves all your problems. Mm-hmm. It's trying to run Excel on your laptop at 100 million rows. It does not work well, even in 64-bit mode.
So, no, it really doesn't. I can tell you that from today's experience.
Yeah. Even my FinOps guy, he asked me, he's like, hey, can I get a server just to load Excel on? Because it kills my laptop every time I try to load the Google billing data. I was like, yeah, we could probably do that. But you should really learn BigQuery. It'll help you out a lot. All right. Well, apparently, according to a report from Business Insider, Amazon is developing a consumer-facing AI chatbot that would compete with OpenAI's ChatGPT and could be revealed later this year. New chatbot service codenamed Metis would be accessed via web browser and provided by a new foundational model, which they already have Titan, so why do they need a new one? The move would join a growing list of technology companies but in their own AI assistants, including Google and Microsoft. Like I said, I assume this will be on top of Titan. They already sort of have a chat bot, which is Q. So I don't... apparently they decided that's not what this thing's going to be powered by, but Metis, I assume, would become part of Alexa if I were to be a guessing person.
Yeah.
That would be my guess as well, especially since they announced a recent overhaul of the Alexa service.
Yeah, and they got to charge for it too. They wouldn't give it away for free.
I heard like maybe $10 a month.
Yeah, no thanks.
Yeah. So you want a device that you're going to put into my house that you're already spying on me with, you want me to charge you $10 to make the spying more relevant to who? Mm. Me or you?
Well, I mean, the promises were, you know, like it would, you could do complex workflows and it would detect workflows patterns and stuff, but you know, who knows what that's actually going to be in practice.
Yeah. I've kind of fallen out of love with my Dingus devices.
Mm-hmm.
I over the last like 6 months, I just find I don't use them like I used to. I don't know if that's just because they're just getting worse or I've just moved on with my life.
They are getting worse. I think at least the echoes that I have around here, because it's just there's lately the support with third-party apps too for like home automation is drying up. So they're changing stuff and then deprecating the APIs, which is no good.
Yeah, I feel the same way. We used to use them a lot, even for like timers and alarms and stuff like that. And we've kind of moved on, I feel like.
Yeah, the kitchen timer is probably the one last place that it still has a lot of value in our house. Beyond that, like the kids maybe play music on theirs in their bedroom sometimes, but that's it. Hmm. Well, moving on to GCP. Google regularly improves the cluster autoscaler, and they want to shed some light on some small improvements they've been making that add up to big improvements for you. First up, target replica count tracking is a new feature that accelerates scaling when you add several pods simultaneously, which could be for new deployments or large resizes. It also eliminates a previous 30-second delay that affected GPU auto-scaling. This capability is headed to open source so that the entire community can benefit from the improved Kubernetes performance that the new cluster autoscaler will bring. Next up is the fast homogeneous scale-up. If you have numerous identical pods, this optimization speeds up scaling the process by efficiently bin packing pods onto nodes. A new less CPU waste, which the cluster autoscaler now makes decisions faster, which is especially noticeable when you need multiple scale-ups across different node pools. And the memory optimization, which is not very visible to most people, but the cluster autoscaler has undergone memory optimizations that contribute to its overall efficiency and improved utilization across your fleet.
Very cool. I mean, I still see dummy workloads for pod scaling and you know, kind of hackery in order to address this issue with some of my spiky workloads. And so, like, this is the more they add these improvements, the more we can sort of stop supporting all this stuff. Good. Awesome.
Yeah. Also, like, other, you know, they are making a point to bring it into the mainstream. So, you know, while it's on GKE, it should move out to the rest of the community. So if you're in other clouds or on-prem or anywhere else, you will get these features, which is nice.
You just have to wait for them to get picked up into Kubernetes core, and then you'll get them. Well, we have a couple of magic quadrants this week, courtesy of Gartner, of course. First up is the magic quadrant for analytics and business intelligence platforms. This one, again, I always find it funny when, you know, Google's the first one to announce it, but that isn't leading it. So, but on top, Microsoft was the leader, followed by Salesforce, but Google, Click, and Oracle were all at the same level in this year's quadrant. AWS has climbed a bit too, which is now leading the challengers box and almost to the point where it could cross over to leaders quadrant, but not quite there yet. They highlight strengths for Google, growth market momentum, excellent composability, and a strong development stack. Cautions, limited augmented analytics backward penetration, which I don't even know what that is, weak product execution of visual data preparation capabilities, and a limited native automated insights. Amazon got strengths of competitive pricing, integrated global cloud service, and a serverless architecture that enables scale and performance. But they got cautioned on their limited deployment options because it's a cloud service. Governance capabilities rely on separated licensed Amazon products and gaps in data preparation capabilities. And Azure got strengths in strong combination of price, functionality, ecosystem, the Copilot brand closely associated with generative AI, and the power portfolio and product ambition of Fabric, with their cautions being governance of content creation publication, unproven interoperability with other services, and Azure is the only deployment option, which, again, I hate it when they ding them on, this is a cloud solution.
Yeah.
That's only available on this cloud.
Yeah, that's kind of a terrible practice.
It's coming up more and more, though, in the Gartner Magic Quadrants, I'm noticing.
What does Copilot have to do with, and Gen AI have to do with this thing? Like, it's like...
Because you want Copilot in all your analytics, so you can ask it to make pretty reports with AI in natural language. That's what they say.
And automatically generate insights based on the data.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, in theory, I haven't played with it yet that much, but I know there's like Copilot for PowerPoint and Excel, and like
it's
supposed to be able to do. Oh, okay. I use it mainly for email and other stuff, and like Teams catch up. I haven't used it in all the other tools in all the other Microsoft Office tools yet.
The biggest problem with all the Copilots in Microsoft land is there's too many of them, and they all cost $30 a month.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No, the sprawl on AI is going to be madness, because I already I have, you know, access to two in the day job, and I compare them frequently. And GitHub Copilot was funnily better at answering questions about BigQuery than Gemini was. But but yeah, no, it's like it's only because I'm not really paying for it yet. Is that okay? But like, by the time you add up all the things that I actually want AI on, yeah, it's going to be like at least five or six or more. And that's kind of a lot.
Yeah. Well, I mean, even just for my own personal, like, I'm paying for Copilot and I'm paying for Gemini for the Cloud Pod, and I'm like, what do I really need to pay for both those? And I think, you know, Jonathan's paying for some of he likes, and then I have also LM Studio, and I have a bunch I downloaded that I like as well. So like, how many AIs do I need?
Yeah. I mean, I'm cheap and miserly, so I'm really focused on, you know, the LM Studio action. But it's, you know, I don't have the hardware to really do anything fun with it. So.
You want to go halves with me? It's just $15,000 each.
It's one time though. It's not, per month.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Plus the megawatt of power needed to do with it.
Right.
Yeah, but that's Jonathan's problem. You're paying for the hardware and you can use it. Jonathan will pay for the power to operate it.
Jonathan has all the solar. He's good.
I know.
Yeah.
Well, the second Magic Quadrant was the data science and machine learning platforms. This one doesn't look that different, except for Databricks, Microsoft, Google, and Amazon are all up in the top right quadrant. And a bunch of other vendors I don't care about and other ones. Google got strength of foundational models, the balanced portfolio of services, and delivery of those services, with cautions of data and AI governance, platform ecosystem, and the core data science capability is their focus without as much machine learning. Amazon got security compliance as their strength, custom AI infrastructure with SageMaker, and training and community as all strengths, with her cautions being their heavy focus on core data science and not ML, the complexity, and the Gen AI market sentiment that Amazon is behind. And then Microsoft gets strengths of enterprise Gen AI capabilities, upskilling, research and development, and cautions of separate product lines, data exploration and visualization, and Copilot integration. So before they got the plus on Copilot, here they got dinged on Copilot.
I just like how SageMaker is like a positive there for AWS. And I'm like, SageMaker has been there for like 10 years, I feel like now. Been there for a long time.
Yeah.
And like, I would say, before nobody used it, and now everyone's like, ooh, SageMaker. And I'm like, it's been there for a long time. Like, do you forget that?
And then the ones that don't like SageMaker, you show them Vertex and they're like, oh, this is so much better. And it's like, it's written by the same product manager that Google stole. It's just Gen 2 of SageMaker.
Mm-hmm. Don't worry about that.
Yeah, don't worry about it. Well, GCP had 5 cost management innovations that they announced at FinOpsX 2024. First up, a BigQuery view that shows billing data in, guess what? Focus. Ooh. So Focus format BigQuery view that's available for free. Speaking in the language of the business, not technology, with the new Gemini Cloud Assist to help you ask natural language questions about all of your billing information. The FinOps Hub is working through cloud environments for sustainability and carbon with new reporting on both of those. Number 4, a new scenario modeling for CUDs with the ability to look at different look-back periods, eliminate data noise, i.e., hey, get rid of Black Friday, because that only happens once a year, and seeing instant results and collaborating with confidence on all of your CUD decisions. And number 5, sending actionable alerts for cost anomaly detection with easy email and PubSub capabilities, as well as direct integration into Slack.
Awesome.
Yeah, that modeling for CUDs was probably the highlight of the announcements from the vendors.
Mm-hmm.
Just ability to do like a lot of different windows. Like Amazon has some look back, so it's like 30 or 90 days. They have a bunch of different carve out periods. And then being able to say like, look, this weekend where that outage happened and we spun up a bajillion Kubernetes clusters that kept failing, or hey, a Black Friday event, or those sort of things. That's nice to be able to just eliminate that and say, that's just a data anomaly. Don't count that into my CUD analysis as I think through it.
That is very cool.
And then they announced Cloud 3.5 Sonnet on Vertex AI.
Ah, that's super expensive.
Was Bedrock also expensive? I didn't check the Bedrock pricing.
I didn't check Bedrock, but on Vertex, it's you pay differently for the input tokens and the output tokens, but effectively, since you want it to be generating stuff because it's Gen AI, $15 per million tokens, which is quite pricey. Like the smaller model, the Haiku model is only $1.25 per million tokens. So just to put it in perspective, Opus is $75 per million tokens.
It's a bit of money.
Not a small model. I'm happy with my $20 a month to Anthropic right now, I think.
Yeah, I think you're a steal of a deal.
You're winning.
Yeah.
I'd be even happier if I could just download the model.
Right.
Well, then you can write it at Elm Studio. Yeah, perfect. DataStream, Google Cloud's serverless change data capture service, recently introduced a new feature called append-only mode that streamlines the process of replicating changes from your operational databases to BigQuery. This feature offers an efficient and cost-effective way to maintain historical records and track changes to operational data over time. In traditional change data capture-based replication, when a record in your source database is updated or deleted, the corresponding record in the destination is overwritten, making it difficult to track the history of those changes. Append-only mode addresses this challenge by preserving every change as a new role on your target BigQuery table, and each row includes metadata that captures the type of change, an insert, update, or delete, a unique identifier, a timestamp, and other relevant information which can be used to order and filter the data as needed. Append-only mode is particularly beneficial in scenarios where you need to maintain a historical record of changes. Some common use cases could include auditing and compliance, trend analysis, customer 360 degree reviews, analyzing embedding drift, and time traveling.
Interesting.
Yeah, I was like, this is cool. I could use this in some auditing use cases for sure.
Time travel would be very interesting to me because that's one of the common things, you know, that I come across, which is, you know, did this exist, right? Because it doesn't exist now. When did it stop existing?
Yeah. It's just so much safer as well. I mean, the last thing you want to do is accidentally replicate deleting a bunch of data to someplace like BigQuery and have to repopulate it from somewhere very expensively. So I think time travel is a great feature.
Yep. I shared it with some people internally at the day job. Okay, this is an interesting way to maybe replace some of our auditing capabilities.
Yeah. And I guess hopefully with well-drafted queries, although you pay more for storage, it doesn't impact performance too much.
I mean, I'm paying for Mongo right now, so.
Well, yeah. Well, Google only takes cash, not souls, so you'll have to.
One day they'll figure out how to monetize your soul, and then they'll take your soul.
Yeah.
Well, Azure continues to be on summer vacation, but they sent their poor FinOps people to FinOps X, instead of going on vacation. So
they don't get a vacation.
Yeah, they don't get one. I have several FinOps X announcements from Azure that they presented. First up is Azure is adding an estimate total cost before deploying from the console. So when you select, 10 of the server type, it'll now tell you the cost right in the console, which please, all other cloud providers, add that. This is my biggest complaint in AWS all the time. It's like, you're using the wizard. I've chosen to use the launch wizard because I'm click-opsing my way through this. You could at least give me the price of what I'm about to do. You get new, deeper insights into Kubernetes costs with detailed AKS breakdowns. The new advisor workbooks to help optimize your costs. New and updated FinOps tools, including Azure Optimization Engine, Cost Optimization Workbook, and FinOps Framework 2024 updates. You can export multiple data sets from Billy, including Focus 1.0 compliant data. So now everyone has it. And self-service analytics via Fabric, for those of you paying through the nose for Fabric.
Yeah.
They had to slide the Fabric in there.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. I'm guessing they spent like a boatload of money getting that developed, and so because they're pushing that hard.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Everywhere.
If you're excited about all of those things, you're going to have to wait for the monthly FinOps update blog post. Because these are all from screenshots that I took of the presentation at the conference that they said on slide. I've yet to release blog posts for, so sorry about that. But hopefully in the monthly FinOps update, they will have all of these items for you to look at, which should be coming out next week because it's the end of the month.
Yeah, that's one of those announcements I actually do look at because there's normally some good tidbits deep buried somewhere in those announcements. Azure really doesn't like to announce the things that they're doing, I feel like.
They're really bad announcing what they're doing. And the things they do announce are just so egregious. You're just like, why? I mean, there's been stuff that they've talked about, a lot of AI announcements that had nothing in them. Like AI for this market segment. I'm like, I don't care. So we haven't been talking about those. But, even like their updates are typically like, we're deprecating a thing. Or there's a new version of a thing that has barely any improvements because it's updated security updates, which isn't helpful either to talk about on the show. So we cut through the noise on that.
Or it's like it's in private preview, then preview, and then public preview, and then something else. Then there's GA. So by the time you get there, you're like, I'm not interested because I'm not going to use it until it's GA'd for production workloads.
And then when they GA it, they don't actually re-announce what it is. So they just give you this thing is GA, and I had to go back and look at what the preview was, actually figure out what the thing. It's really like they need a Jeff Barr at Azure. Like their DevRel is bad.
Yeah, it's a pain point for me on my day job because I try to keep up and keep track of things, and there's just times I'm like, I don't know what you've actually released because all it says is this thing has been GA'd or we've added support for this thing in this place. I'm like, cool. Anything real here?
Well, and I was like, as I always refer back, like, well, for those of us who've been with us since the early adopter version, we've made these significant changes. And you're like, cool, what was it before? Mm-hmm. So you had to, like, it takes a lot of work to go through those announcements, which I do for you. So you're welcome, listeners.
And me.
And Matt as well.
I definitely steal Justin's work.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thank you.
Oracle, again, also at the FinOps X, they had announced something, and they're announcing the launch of FinOps Hub. FinOps spirit by being on the floor and announcing their FinOps Hub product to all of us. Businesses can track cloud resource costs more closely than ever. With FinOps Hub, it helps practitioners to answer several questions, including, are our budgets on track? Do we have enough credits left so we don't pay overages or get sued by Oracle? What resource groups have the greatest impact on cost? What can I optimize my cost? And how can I prevent unauthorized spending because I don't want the lawyers to attack me?
I mean, I like this, but it is my temptation is just to make fun of Oracle as usual.
Mm-hmm. I like that.
They like try to like actually make it, you know, where everyone else like has it. They're like, are we on track? Like trying to make it actually be an actual item for a person versus like, here's your budget or like, here's a deeper dive into it. Like, it feels like they went with the action oriented approach. Like, am I over budget? Am I going to have to pay more money? Is my CFO going to yell at me type of thing? You know, versus like, here's integration to Kubernetes or whatever else. So I feel like they went the action route of like the business route, which I think is interesting.
I do like that angle. It is a nice change of pace. Like, here's what we're trying to help you answer. So, you know, when you go Google for this later, like, my CEO's yelling at me, how can I save money? I'll be like, here's a tool you can use that'll help you save money. So it does help in the SEO side as well.
Well, budgets are so invisible to most people in the organization now, I think. And so if they're building tooling, which makes it, puts it in front of people and it shows you what the budget is and shows you where you are on track or not on track, it's just a useful tool. It's a nice perspective.
I can't relate to you, Jonathan, because I live in my budget.
I can't yell for my budget.
Not being aware of your budget? Like, what? That's a weird thing. I don't know what that's like.
We don't let you design anything, though.
So. That's true.
Yeah.
I just yell at you when you spend too much money for my budget. Yeah, that works. Well, that's another fantastic week here in the cloud, and we're heading into the 4th of July holiday. So hopefully for those of you who are going off of town, this podcast will find you well on the 4th of July holiday.
See you later, guys.
Bye, everybody.
And that is The Week in Cloud. Check out our website, the home of the Cloud Pod, where you can join our newsletter, Slack team, send feedback, or ask questions at thecloudpod.net, or tweet us with the hashtag #PoundTheCloudPod. All right, well, I have all four of you here, so I've been saving an after-show topic because we are evenly split between Android users and iPhone users.
Oh, wow.
And WWDC just happened.
Come on, Jonathan, help me out.
This is the time of year that I like to hear, you know, we're talking about what they announced, and then and Jonathan can say, yeah, Android's had that for 5 years.
Yeah.
So the highlights of the 13 highlights of it, and there's a lot of other features that come out too, but first up is they have their own version of AI they're calling Apple Intelligence. So it's going to be apparently in iPhone, iPad, and Macintosh computers, which I found funny because they have Apple Intelligence, which is going to have a bunch of its own compute servers that they're going to use to do off-device AI computing. But if their AI cannot answer your question, you'll have the option to send the data to OpenAI, and then OpenAI's ChatGPT can answer the question for you, which... Then Elon Musk basically got on Twitter and was like, if you put OpenAI into the iPhones, we'll ban iPhones and Apple devices on our campus, which I thought was just, okay, Elon, you're just mad because Apple
no
didn't
one's gonna
choose
use
you
Grok.
For Grok.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is this supported by the vendor in any of the cloud vendors natively?
I don't think so. It's not in Bedrock. It's not anything that I'm aware of. And I don't even think it's really even available other than in Twitter, and what's available in Twitter is not great, but I'm not paying for it either, so maybe that's my problem. It's maybe the key. But you know, the nice thing about this, they are doing ChatGPT, they said first, but they are open to the idea of having Gemini. They also said they're going to be building out their own LLM model. So that one, I think you guys have us on this one, Android. I think you guys are already integrating into ChatGPT and Gemini. I assume I already have ChatGPT on my iPhone. I have the app. But having it natively in the operating system is kind of nice.
Yep, already have Gemini. Don't use it. It doesn't work properly.
Perfect. Yeah,
don't worry. It won't work on iPhone either.
Yeah.
And like just doing basic things like, you know, the kitchen timer you mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Like hey, cool. Start a timer for 5 minutes. And so it doesn't open it in the clock app where you think it would do with a stopwatch that persists. Like if you turn your phone off or switch to a different browser, then no, it opens up in a browser on a page. And
really?
Oh yeah, it's crap. Really?
Yeah. That's actually the only feature I use the Hey Google feature for on my phone, which is to...
Is that using Gemini though? Is that using a Gemini interface or not?
I think you're right. I think I never authorized it to steal all my data.
Yeah, well, don't bother.
They already have Jonathan's got it.
Wow, that sounds riveting. I'm sold on the Android phone off that conversation.
Yeah.
Siri is getting an AI boost. So they're basically going to be, again, that ChatGPT linkage from Siri, which anything to make Siri better is a win in my book because Siri is the worst. And so I'm hoping, you know, when they get their own LLM that I don't have to have the ChatGPT part of Siri, but that's going to be nice. So I guess on the home assistants, which I have one that's in a box that I've never taken out of in my drawer, does it have access to Gemini?
Don't know. But I tend not to use those things anymore. Ryan said, like put them in a drawer and don't use them anymore. Mm-hmm. I've been playing with some free stuff like Mycroft and Home Assistant to try and get away from the cloud connected services.
You know, you do a cloud pod every week.
Yeah.
Or is that why?
Yeah.
One of the two.
We already talked about ChatGPT and Siri, so that one we already talked about. We're getting all these AI features in mail, messages, and photos. And the most important feature of this one, I think, is that we're getting custom emojis that you can you can put common text into, and it'll create you a custom emoji of whatever text you put into the Apple Assistant thing there. So do you guys have that on Android?
Yes. It's like if I write in a text message like, how are you doing? It like pops up and gives you options for like different like bubbles and bubble letters and other things like that.
So Apple does that too, where if you're in a text message and you write in like chicken, it'll pop up like, would you like to replace the word chicken with the chicken emoji?
I don't know. It does that too. But it also just like any text. Like you do like a small phrase, it will give you the option to like write it in, you know, some fun letters and colors. Mm-hmm. It's really fun like that.
I turned off those features for the messaging app because, I don't know, if it wasn't sent to me a message, I want to send my message the way I want it to somebody. So, but yeah, I think Pixel at least have the sort of like AI integrated things. I'm not sure if they do custom emojis yet or not, but they did like custom backgrounds and various other custom things that you could do.
Nice. This one I know Android's had for a long time. We're getting more customizations for iOS home screens, so we don't have to have just, you know, sheets of apps anymore. We can actually put, you know, we've been able to put widgets in place for now, but we're actually able to like create like, this is a clean space on my photo that I don't want obstructed by icons now. As well as we're going to be able to do multiple home screens for different things. Like I want a gaming home screen and I want a productivity and I want a work one. And I know you guys have had that for a while.
Can we do that now?
In iPads, you can do sidecar, which is sort of similar, but this is like sidecar on steroids.
I can do a different home screen depending on my focus.
That you can do, but this is like actually saying I only want this home screen is only going to have 5 icons. Mm-hmm. You can also you can also decide that you don't want custom color. You don't want custom icons anymore. You can make them all the same color. You can theme them different ways. There's a lot of customization to the look and feel of your iPhone coming in iOS 18.
Very cool.
The placement of apps was like one of the things that you drove me absolutely crazy when I had an iPhone. Mm-hmm. Was like, it had to go in the row and across. And I was like, what if I want like it vertically? No, you can't do that. Like you don't be creative like that. That's how I always felt. It always, that was like the thing that drove me absolutely crazy with iPhones and to an absurd level. And I don't know why.
Yeah, no, I get it. Right. Cause the minute you start playing around with widgets, they're also constricted in size and placement. And so it's like, well, I don't want those 4 apps that they're the only thing I have left for. I would rather those just be on their other page, but I can't do it.
Yeah.
Can you put them in folders? Hmm? Yeah. Can I like drag them all into a folder?
But I'd rather just that space be blank, right? Like,
Oh, wow. Like, so, I mean, I can sell an app that has like no icon, a transparent icon on the Apple Store, just for people to put on the home screen to block out certain spaces. Oh, hell, if I'd known that, I would have done ages ago. Yeah. $3.99. Invisible app.
Next up is RCS support, which Android has had for a while, but this is supposedly going to make the green versus blue fight that we all have. Why we don't have a Cloud Pod chat team message. Because we have to have Jonathan and Matt in there. And that's terrible. Yeah. But apparently that's going to be coming out. We're rolling out that. I haven't heard if RCS is still going to be green text boxes. I assume it's going to be.
They did announce that it'd still be green, but it's going to support much more of.
Yeah, you can do edits. You can do tap backs. You can do all the things that RCS supports, basically, you can do, which, you know, that's all I really wanted. And thank you, Apple. Well, actually, thank you, EU, for making Apple do this.
Yeah. It's the sending of photos and like videos I have a kid is like from last week when I show up on time, you know, and I have a group friend chat where like we're go to the farmer's market or wherever, and somebody sends a picture, and like if I'm in this thread with, you know, three of like our other friend that's a really good couple, I can't get the picture, it's crap, or the video is like 160 by 160 pixels. So I'm like, come on, guys.
Well, maybe we'll get a group chat. We'll let you know in October.
All right.
Apple TV Plus adds Insights, which is the same thing as Amazon Prime X-Ray. It basically gives you real-time information on who is on your TV, the scene is about, etc. Apparently, Apple's going to be using machine learning to do this, which I think is a terrible choice. Amazon uses an army of Indian people or Amazon Turks to basically specify the stuff for you, so you don't have to do this. And you know, we'll see which one works better. I never have used X-Ray, I will honestly say. So I don't think I'll ever use Insights, but it's there if I want it.
Can you not use it? Like when you pause it, it automatically comes up, right?
I mean, do I read it? No. Yes, it pops up. Also, I don't watch that many Prime shows.
My TV has those features. Is it LG? I think LG has a feature where they look at what's on screen and then try and send you targeted ads or other things of interest and stuff like that. I turned all that crap off.
I don't care about that much. Password Zap. So I already had to move off the last password because I got hacked many times. I'm now on 1Password. And now when 1Password gets hacked someday, I will now have a Password Zap on my iPhone or Mac devices that'll all be synchronized. So I can have my own standalone app. Yes, it's already been there. I know this is a standalone app, just like your 1Password or your LastPass. So you don't have to go into the keychain anymore to find your password, which was a terrible experience.
That's true.
So they changed something kind of like fundamental at the operating system level to support this now, assuming that the password app will have to be able to fill in forms in other apps.
Yeah, I mean, they've had that in Safari forever. And they even have a plugin for Chrome that talks to the passwords that are in your keychain. But if you wanted to go edit them, or you had like a desktop app that you need to get a password for, it didn't, you know, going into keychain to get your password was very painful.
And the standalone apps have had that access on Apple to like input into an application, a password for a while now. Mm-hmm.
iPadOS is adding a calculator app, which for those of you who are on Android tablets, you're like, what? You didn't have a calculator on your iPads? Yes, it's been a long suffering thing where you had to go buy a third party calculator app on iPads forever.
Really?
Yes.
Really?
This has been...
It's on iPhones, iPads?
There is a native iPhone app for calculator that has never been ported to iPhone or iPad until now. And they've added pencil support. I don't know why. Like there's the only reason why, and honestly, the only reason why it's there is they added pencil support, and there's ability to you can go now write out formulas with the pencil in the notes app or in the calculator app, and it'll actually do the math equation now. And so this is just a way to demo. Cool. It is a cool feature. This is just a way to demo that pencil support, and so they're like, "Well, port the calculator app over, then we'll add this capability." And so now we have it finally on iPads, which is great, and we get a pencil support to do drawn out equation. So, I don't know if you guys have anything on the Android side that does this exactly. I'm sure a third-party app does. I could have done it with a third-party app on iPad as well. But this one looks pretty neat for your iPad users.
Native? No, I don't think so. Well, at least not on stock Android. I know Samsung has a whole bunch of extra bloatware that they ship, and they have pencil support and sort of Motorola. I don't know about the calculator app, though, but I tend to use like the Wolfram Alpha search, which would do the same thing, like take pictures of the equations and solve it for you for your homework if you need to.
I didn't know I'd do pictures.
Mac OS 15 will let you mirror your iPhone to your Mac OS, so you can control your Mac or your iPhone from your computer directly, which is kind of cool. Which also is supposed to fix a bunch of the audio problems with continuity between the iPhone and the Mac. So this one you guys definitely don't have, but I appreciate this one.
That is a cool feature though.
Yeah. Especially if you're a Mac developer or an iPhone developer, I think it's something, because right now the only way to do that on a Mac is you have to do an emulator inside of Xcode. And so, you know, that's a slow emulated experience, even though they're all ARM processors now, you think it'd be fine. It's still slow and painful. And you could connect to your third-party device to do it that way too. But now you'll be able to actually mirror it to your computer. So I think it's, I don't know how practical it's going to be. I like the idea of it, but we'll see.
I can't think of a single use that I would use.
That's because you're not an iPhone developer.
That's true.
But it's, I mean, other thing you do is, like, if you have your work laptop, if you have a Mac and your work laptop, you could connect messages to your work laptop, which is probably not the best idea because your work laptop is being spied on by your corporate overlord all the time. And all your text messages could be sucked out of your Macintosh. It's from the, so you're, if you're just mirroring the iPhone, you'd be able to do text messaging through the mirror.
So you're saying that the sharing won't be tied to your iCloud account? Because
I'm sure it'll be tied to your iCloud account.
Bad news.
I'm sure it will be. But what you decide to sync to your device is a different conversation. I don't know. We'll see. This one, I don't know if I'll use it either, to be honest, but it's new. Apple Watch gets Surface Widgets, which is this dumb thing on iPhones where basically we built an island, which you guys make fun of us all the time with our iPhone, you know, forehead island. That basically, there's this thing that Apple developers have done where they basically, like, if you're going on a United flight, for example, it'll pop up in that dead space above the island. It'll tell you how long until your flight boards and all these things when you look at the home screen. So you get like this live widget information that's in a very convenient place. And that didn't exist on the watch, and now it'll be on the watch too. I don't know. Androids have watches, but I don't know what they do or anything about them because I don't know anybody owns one.
So what's it doing exactly? It's just like providing contextual information.
It's like a real-time widget that just lives. It isn't a widget. It just embeds into the screen, basically.
So if I set a timer and then I close my phone, then the timer still stays visible on the top of my screen. Or, you know, when I'm listening, if you're listening to Spotify or something, the song information will be there. It's just, and it's dynamic. Like it just, and it, you know, sort of stays with the open apps, but sort of doesn't. So kind of, it's just sort of a helpful thing. I kind of like it.
I mean, we've got lock screen widgets. So if you set a timer, It'll send lock screen.
But do you have to add that widget to your thing, or does it?
No, no, it just appears. It can based on context.
It's basically, the feature you guys have had forever. But
yeah, you know, so like if you got a flight in your calendar, it pops up contextual information about when to leave for the airport and whether it's late or not, that kind of thing. But Google have been reading our emails for 20 years now.
Yeah.
So.
Mm-hmm. For those of you who have a Vision OS 2, which is not me because I cannot justify $3,400 for it. It'll support spatial photos and ultra-wide Mac display. So you can, if you're using your Mac inside your Vision OS 2, you can have a bigger screen. It's a weird one. And then AirPods Pro will let you quietly respond to Siri. So instead of being a douchebag in a party trying to respond to your Siri, your AirPods, you can now just whisper to it.
I kind of like that, right? Because that's one of my biggest gripes about all voice activated anything is that it's like socially, like I'll want to know something and then I have to be like, you know, stop a conversation and ask some robot something.
Mm-hmm.
And it feels very awkward. So I kind of like the idea of being able to do that a little quieter.
There you go. So that's it. I think we basically confirmed that nothing we got was not already an Android, other than maybe some weird quality of life improvements that you guys don't need.
I mean, the mirroring thing is useful because, I mean, Android has had mirroring for a long time, but it's only one way. So you can cast the screen to something else, but you couldn't, there's no backward path to like click on buttons and that kind of thing. Unless you use the Android debugger, but then that's a whole, you know, that's not a consumer product. Yeah. So that is kind of cool.
Wow, that was, all right, cool.
Yeah.
Well, that's it. That's all I got. You guys can bring to me the Android party when you guys release the next version of Android. We don't even know which dessert are you guys on these days in the Android world. Is that still a thing? The last time I had an Android was Eclair, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, that's about the same time I had one. Yeah. That's a long time ago.
I can't remember. They stopped making the
Well, they stopped pastry, sweets, whatever.
They probably did because Google killed all the fun, but
It was upside down. 14 is upside down cake. 13, just for Justin and Jonathan and Ryan here, is tiramisu.
That's an inside joke there that no one will understand.
Yeah. No one will understand.
But we will laugh about it.
Yeah.
And 15, which is coming out, I guess third beta just came out. So I guess it's soon getting released, is vanilla ice cream. Like they had to stretch with some of these ones.
Yeah. Well, in the Mac world, you know, we named macOS after places in California. So right now we're on Sonoma, but the new version will be Sequoia, which I actually remembered that one. Sequoia was is something I heard. Like most of the names, they choose like Catalina and
Monterey.
I never remember them most of the time. That's how that works. But Sequoia, I'll remember that one. I remembered it every time it's come up. Like, well, yeah, the new Mac version. Oh, yeah, Sequoia.
Is Sequoia a place?
I don't know.
Yeah. I'm just wondering if it's a departure. I mean, I'm sure there's a Sequoia. There's
Sequoia
place.
National Park.
Yeah, Sequoia National Park. Yeah, that's a thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a place. I mean, because they also had, what was the big rock? El Capitan in Yosemite was a thing at one time.
Oh, yeah. No, you're right. Yeah, that would be, it sort of fits in that theme. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So it's a California landmark. That's all you need to know. I'm surprised they haven't used Golden Gate or anything like that. But anyways, that's it. We'll see you guys next week.
All right. See you later.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Bye.